Conestoga Podcast, episode 33 for Wednesday, August 21st, 2007. A couple of episodes ago, I mentioned something about a lemur incident on one of the upcoming podcasts recorded at Conestoga 11. Our charity this year was Safari Sanctuary, and they brought a lot of their exotic animals to the con, including a lemur. During the recording of an interview, one of our guests had a close encounter of the lemur kind. I suppose if you Google the word lemur, Conestoga, and any one of the named guests in attendance will probably turn up the likely suspect. But until you hear it, you won't know exactly what happened. So, rather than keep you in suspense, I will tell you that it did not occur during the recording of this podcast interview with our artist guest of honor, John Picasso. Welcome once again to the Conestoga Podcast. This afternoon, I have our artist guest of honor today, John Picasso, and I want to thank you for joining me today.
Right on. It's good to be here.
This is Sunday, the third day of the convention, and I kind of want to get some of your input on how you've enjoyed it so far.
It's been a great show. I mean, these folks, they know how to put on a show, and they've been extremely gracious, and we've had a great time. We've had a very, very good time here.
Well, I've certainly enjoyed spending a little bit of time with you during the convention, and I must say you are definitely a class act.
Oh, thank you. It's been good. We've enjoyed, my wife Tracy and I, we've really enjoyed ourselves.
Well, I'm actually fairly new to your work. I first encountered it at Worldcon in 2005. I saw the display and I was very impressed with it, and I have been noticing it ever since. And of course, when I went to ArmadilloCon last year, I picked up your book Cover Story, and it's just got some amazing covers in it.
Thank you.
You've built up quite a body of work over the past 10 years, and especially for some rather well-known authors, reprints of books like Gateway or Macro Life, Canica for Leibowitz. Mm-hmm. How were you able to land gigs like that?
It's a good question. I guess I've been fortunate, first of all. I think a lot of my work earlier in my career was for the small press publishers, and I still do work for some of them. But I think I built up a body of work that showed that I could be versatile. I think that there are, I guess there was, the very first work I ever did was for a reissue of a classic. You know, it was Behold the Man, the 30th anniversary edition by Michael Moorcock. That came out from Mojo Press in 96, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And I did the cover in these black and white ink drawings for that book. And that was kind of the job that kind of changed my life, really, because to that point I had been doing architecture and comic books, and had never done a book cover, and never thought to do a book cover.
Mm-hmm.
And not only did I do the cover for that, but I designed the book all the way through, and it really, like I said, changed my life. It gave me a crash course in design, and I had a lot of design experience and problem solving via the architecture world and even through the comics, but having to sort of address a book and not just think of it just as a cover job, but as an object all the way through.
Mm-hmm.
Spine, flaps, headers, interior layouts. It made me think of the book as a totality, and that was valuable. And but I, just to address your question again, coming back to it, you know, mm-hmm. reissues. That was a reissue essentially, mm-hmm. or a new edition of an old book. And I think there's maybe a bit of a motif that goes through some of my work, maybe more through the older stuff than some of my newer, but the idea of taking something that somebody else has disposed of, mm-hmm. and making it beautiful again.
Yeah.
Or turning it into something that it wasn't before, but hopefully is now of value. And so, you know, I'm not going to say these reissues were discarded, but certainly a book that has sort of seen its day, perhaps, and trying to sort of reinvigorate it and present it to a new audience. I enjoy those challenges, and maybe publishers recognize that, perhaps, and have given me a fair amount of them. I welcome those, but I also like doing the new stuff, the state of the art stuff.
Oh yeah, you do have quite a few original covers as well. I've noticed that over the years, one of my favorite books is A Canonical for Leibowitz, and I've seen a number of covers over the years, and I must say I like yours the best.
Oh, it's kind of you, very kind of you. HarperCollins EOS is the publisher of that cover you're talking about. And it's interesting with that book. Currently, Bantam holds the rights to the mass market paperback, and HarperCollins EOS has the rights to the trade paperback, in at least in America. I don't know about elsewhere, but at least in America, North America. And I think the Bantam cover is pretty sweet. I actually rather like that cover. Mm-hmm. But I've been pleasantly surprised to see the Harper trade paperback cover, the one that I did. That seems to be the one that most bookstores seem to choose. And that's quite nice. You know, I think these things go in cycles, though. I don't pat myself on the back too hard about that. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just that, you know, someday there will be somebody else's cover that will supplant mine. But for right now, it just seems that seems to be the face of that book, at least in this continent. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm quite grateful and honored about that, because I think that is a great book. Mm-hmm. It's one of my faves as well.
Well, I don't think you have to pat yourself on the back. You've won plenty of accolades and awards already. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, last night, I believe you were telling me you recently won the Locus Award.
Yeah, that was a shocker. Yeah. That was a shocker.
Who are you up against?
Against a little-known artist named Michael Whalen. I don't know how many Locus Awards Michael has won. I think it's somewhere in the 20s. I could be wrong. But anyway, he's clearly, you know, as he is in most facets of this field, you know, the dominant mm-hmm. figure when it comes to that award. And so he was in that five. I want to say John Jude Palancar. Golly, I'm blanking here, but you know, it was basically, you know, four of the just most amazing mm-hmm. illustrators. For me to be in that company with those guys, it was quite a thing. I want to say Charles Vess, I think, mm-hmm. was in there. Well, but anyway, just the my point being that I thought I had no chance, to be honest.
Wow.
I was fortunate, I thought, to be in that five. I was in that five last. I was in the final five last year. And I thought, well, it's nice to be nominated for a second year in a row, but have no illusions whatsoever that I'm going to win this thing. Mm-hmm. And was just kind of sitting there when they called my name. I thought, that was actually my name they just called.
So you kind of sat there like a deer in the headlights for a few seconds?
Well, just for a split second, and then realized, wow, I better get up there and say mm-hmm. something. The art book was also my art book cover story, The Art of John Picasso. That mm-hmm. was up for best art book as well in the Locus Awards, and finished second to Spectrum, which is mm-hmm. which is always terrific. Spectrum's always phenomenal. And it was quite a thing. I was very, very fortunate and honored to win that this year. It's a big deal. I mean, there's only, I think in the history of that award, it's been going, 30-something years, and it's a handful of artists that have won it. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think you've got Whalen, Leo and Diane Dillon, Bob Eagleton. Again, I'm blanking on the other names, but it's a very small list. I think I'm like the seventh or eighth wow. on that list.
Well, that's okay. Google is our friend.
Yeah. That's what Google's for, not for me to sit here and blather
yeah.
on.
Yeah, and I'll put links and show notes and all the good stuff on the website. And yes, you've a couple other awards. You've got the International Horror Guild Award. You got the Chesley Award in 2005.
Yep.
Then a world
six. Actually, 2006. Well, I won 2005 for best paperback cover. For Her Smoke Rose Up Forever by uh-huh. James Tiptree Jr. That was the paperback cover. But then 2006, I won the Chesley for Artistic Achievement, which is mm-hmm. essentially sort of their Artist of the Year award. And that was a big deal to me. Mm-hmm. And it probably will forever be a big deal to me, because that's yeah. sort of the artist award to their fellow artists. And that's a heavy thing. And yeah. I took great pride in that.
And
still do.
For those that are not familiar with the Chesley, it's named in honor of the space artist Chesley Bonestell, which I learned how to pronounce, who just, you know, done some amazing work. And it was very nice that they named an award in his honor. And it's put on by ASFA, which I...
The Association of Science Fiction and Fantasy Artists. Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was quite a thing. So the cover we were just talking about for A Canticle for Leibowitz, mm-hmm. ASFA just put out their 2007 long list. And Canticle is up. It's on the long list, at least, for best paperback cover. And there's an Interzone cover, I think, that's up for best magazine. And I mean, the awards are fantastic. I mean, I really appreciate it, but it's not why I do what I do. I do because I enjoy this work, and mm-hmm. I'm grateful to be a part of this field.
Well, the work has to be rewarding in itself, and I think it certainly shows when we look at your covers and your original artwork. I understand, although I don't know when this podcast will be out, so it could come out before Japan or after Japan. Most likely it'll be after Japan. So you're heading off to Worldcon again this year?
Yeah, I'm gonna skip San Diego Comic-Con, which I usually do every year, and go ahead and go for it and go to Japan, which I wasn't planning to go to originally for Worldcon. I was going to skip it this year. But then I found out I was nominated for 2 Hugos, and that kind of changed the plan a little bit.
Yeah.
And I said, well, you know what? A single Hugo nomination in 1 year is a terrific mm-hmm. thing. But to get nominated for 2 in 1 year, that's probably never going to happen again. Yeah. It may, but that's pretty rare. And you've got to savor something like that. Mm-hmm. So I decided that, you know, I really need to find a way to get out there.
Yeah.
So I am. I'll be out there, and it's going to be terrific. Again, just like the Locus Awards thing, I'm not mm-hmm. expecting to win it. Either one. I'm just going to go there just to enjoy the experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. My fellow podcaster, the Balticon podcast, Paul Fisher, he's also going to Japan as well. So maybe I'll tell him to go say hi, track you down and say hi.
Oh, that sounds good. That sounds good.
Now, one thing I've noticed, I was, you know, perusing your book cover story. It has a very nice interview, which I don't think I need to ask those questions again.
No, you can. Joe McCabe did that interview.
Yeah.
He's a terrific journalist based out mm-hmm. of, I'm going to say it, Bryn Mawr, I believe, mm-hmm. Over near Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm.
He's terrific.
Here are my impressions of the covers, and I'm sure you've probably heard a lot of different people talk about your covers and tell you what they think of them, but there seems to be a glowing quality that actually feels like they're actually glowing to me. Now, of course, I'm colorblind, so maybe I'm viewing
really?
It a little differently.
Really?
Yes.
That's interesting.
I have a mild form of red-green colorblindness.
Wow.
But there's a richness to your covers, and what they remind me of, although it's very different than they remind me of the Byzantine icons, the gold coloring. Although you do use a lot of different colors other than the gold, and of course that artwork is a very different style. But it evokes in me a similar emotion when I look at your artwork.
Well, that's very interesting. I never connotated my work with that in any way, shape, mm-hmm. or form. But, you know, when you say the shimmer of Byzantine artwork, I will say Gustav Klimt has always been an influence. I more in compositionally maybe than in terms of his technical approach, but his compositional approach maybe, and his way of combining 3D and 2D forms and having mm-hmm. that push and pull between the two. I would certainly say that was an early influence, mm-hmm. but his work always had a shimmer to it, didn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And maybe there could be something, you know, subconsciously kind of carrying through in my work that way. That's an interesting insight. I never would have thought of that.
Well, you know, authors, you know, everyone gets something different.
Yeah, and that's what the work is there. You know, once I'm finished with it, just as with any creator. It's given to the audience, and it's for them to filter through their own minds, and mm-hmm. and yeah, it doesn't really belong to me anymore, does it?
Yeah,
you know?
it sort of takes,
and I'm cool with that.
And it does take a life of its own. Yeah. I mean, you hope it does. Certainly. I mean, a lot of people use superlatives. Unique is not a superlative, but you certainly do have a unique visual style. I mean, you know, other artists, you know, Michael Whelan, Frank Kelly Fries, they've all, you know, carved out their own territories, and I think you have carved out your own territory as well.
That's very kind. I mean, I think that what we're trying to do in any field of art or creativity is take the vocabulary that's come before us, hopefully add our own bits, respond to our own time, and that phrase I think is a key: responding to your own time, and then pass it off to the next generation or the next wave. So whatever I'm doing right now, I'm hopefully responding to what's come before me, and maybe more importantly to me, responding to where I am and what the world is, the world that exists around me right now. And when I say that, I'm saying, technologically, culturally, you know, this sort of mixture that I do of mixed media and digital on some of my work, and not all of my work is done that way, but currently the vast majority is, where I'm combining traditional approaches and then scanning them in and collaging them to get these traditional elements together digitally. There's a bit of a conscious it's a conscious response by me to the technology that's available right now and the things that I think are that our current society and the allows us to be able to explore. So I think that if I were just going to sit there and explore things completely traditionally, I think I'd be not exploring avenues that are open to me, and I think I'd feel like I was not pushing it far enough. Well, and I think that's important if we're going to consider ourselves artists to push that to push the limits, the edges of those envelopes. And I don't even think I'm really pushing as far as I could be. You know, I think right now I sort of feel like, okay, I'm feeling the limitations of this thing right now. What's the next thing? I don't quite know what that is, but I think that's our role. That is what artists are supposed to do. And I'm also very careful to call myself an artist yet. I think that's something you earn. Right now I'm an illustrator. That's my role. I want to be an artist, though. I mean, and I hope that the work I do is with the apt the. I hope it's worthy of being called an artist, but that's not really for me to decide either. So, although I hope I can be an artist, I don't know if I am yet.
I would certainly say you are. You know, I want to. We're going to talk about the technologies that you use. You know, to talk about those a little bit later, but I want to back up a little bit. I want to you come from a slightly different background than a lot of people who do illustrations and artwork. You come from a background in architecture, and first of all, chose you to choose architecture, and then how you shifted into doing cover illustrations.
Yeah, architecture. I mean, it was as simple as I've been drawing my whole life, and I was fortunate enough in high school to have some scholarships come my way, and you've got sort of an open door to go to some decent schools, and you've got your pick of what you want to do. And it was a bit of pressure, perhaps, maybe subconscious pressure to do something a little more, that would be more of a sure thing than maybe just an art degree might entail. So, you know, I had a chance to go for a professional degree, and I chose architecture just for the naive factor that it could be something where I could draw for a living. I mean, it was as stupid and as simple as that, really, and not really a great reason to do architecture. But, you know, clearly there's a creative element to that field, and that was attractive too. I didn't know what the hell I was doing, to be quite honest. It sounded more interesting to me than engineering or being a lawyer, certainly. So, you know, I was open to it, and I didn't know what I was getting into, quite frankly. There wasn't like a background in my family or some sort of you know, inertia like that made me say, well, you know, I should be an architect or I should be going for that. It was just, hey, I can draw for a living. That would be great. And it's probably more of a sure thing than being an animator or a special effects guy or something. But what it did for me, though, when it was all said and done, is it gave me a confidence in process, in thinking through problems and thinking about materials in open ways. And this was all stuff that kind of developed over the course of this 5-year education that I had at the University of Texas. And I think that stuff still carries me through a lot of my days in illustration. I mean, that confidence that I have in process and problem solving, it's invaluable to what we do here. And when we're working through a cover illustration assignment or a magazine illustration assignment, and those skills have really been valuable to me, invaluable. And, as far as how I got started in book covers, I mean, I was doing, when I graduated, I started working in architecture, residential architecture to be specific, custom, and self-publishing my own comic books. And the covers for those comics were noticed by a couple of companies, but most specifically Mojo Press. And they gave me that aforementioned job, which was Behold a Man, the 30th anniversary edition by Michael Moorcock. And, like I said before, that kind of changed everything. I mean, it really was one of those things that just kind of came out of the blue. I really didn't ever expect to be working in books. I had always admired the genre, clearly. I had always been reading the stuff. But for whatever reason, I just didn't put the two things together. So, you know, I've always felt a bit of gratitude, more than a bit of gratitude, to the guys who were involved in that decision process. You know, you've got the editor, Rick Claw. You've got the publisher of that company, Ben Ostrander. And of course, you got the author, Mike Moorcock, who I still have a terrific friendship with to this day. I'm indebted to those guys because I think they saw something in me that maybe I didn't quite see in myself at that moment. Hopefully, eventually, I would have figured it out.
Yeah.
But maybe they saw it before I did. But it... definitely the light went on. Well, I mean, and it never went off, thankfully.
Well, I think we're grateful for that. You talk about Mojo Press. Now, your book cover story, which has a lot of the covers that you've done, is put up by Monkey Brain Press, which is a small press as well. And I noticed you
Monkey Brain Books. Yeah.
Monkey Brain Books. Yeah. You've done a number of covers also for them as well.
Sure.
And how did you get involved with that particular group?
Yeah, Monkey Brain is owned by Chris Robertson and Allison Baker. Chris Robertson's one of those guys that has 32 hours in a day. I don't know quite how he juggles what he juggles, but he's one of those very few figures that I see that's actually successful. You see a lot of guys who try to be successful on multiple fronts, but this guy actually is in the three fronts being author, editor, and publisher.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that he's been able to be acclaimed in all three of them, it blows me away. It's tough enough for me to be able to be, you know, work at a high level in one field, and he's doing it in three. And he co-owns this company along with his wife, and they're good friends of mine, quite frankly. And we've sort of come up in the business together, along with a few other people, including a guy named Lou Anders, who's the editorial director at Pyre. And so Chris and Allison were starting up this company, Monkey Brain. Their first book was Heroes and Monsters, the unofficial companion to the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen by a guy named Jess Nevins. And we had known each other. They needed a cover, and they came to me, and that's how the relationship started. Mm-hmm. There's been a trust along the way of sort of allowing me to design the covers as well as illustrate them, and that, you know, that's something I enjoy, and I think there's sometimes when you have one person doing it all the way through, there's a more cohesive solution, and there's a great deal of satisfaction.
Well, it certainly sounds like that partnership has paid off for you.
Yeah, well, hopefully both ways, you know, and I think they've definitely been nominated for some awards very quickly that, you know, some people might not have expected, and they've gotten a fair amount of acclaim, and, you know, so hopefully, it's certainly that the relationship has helped me, and hopefully I've helped them.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, you can go to his website, look at his book. I mean, the list of authors and people that he's done covers for is just, you know, it's a who's who list. What I want to do is let's move back to the technologies. You talked about using different digital technologies to involved in your artwork, and you said you didn't feel like you're quite pushing the limits of the technology yet. But what are some of the things that you do in the composition that you couldn't have done, say, like 10 or 15 years ago?
Well, just to get back to maybe some of the things you said before you got to that final question,
okay.
If I said the limits of the technology, then I probably misspoke. I think the limits of possibility is what I'm more trying to discuss here. You know, I mean, to me, getting bogged down in the technology is not what I'm interested in, and pursuing that at the expense of becoming a better traditional draftsman, traditional painter, is not what I'm interested in. I'm interested in the possibilities of what, and in this case, the software we're talking about is Photoshop. It's the only one I use. I'm not really interested in trying out different bits of software. I'm kind of just interested in what the Photoshop, in this instance, allows me to do, which is this whole thing of what I call compositing, sandwich making is what I say. You know, the elements of the sandwich being these things that I create by hand, these drawings and paintings, and Photoshop being sort of the sandwich maker and allowing me to sort of align these ingredients and combine them in ways that maybe I couldn't have in the real world. And you know, I'm not interested in it for its filters or its drawing and paint. I'm not interested in dragging a stylus on a Wacom tablet.
Right.
And I probably never will be, to be quite honest. There's a lot of great illustrators that are really, really good at it, and I have no problem with that form of expression and form of illustration. No problem whatsoever. But I'm not interested in it personally. I'm interested in being a better draftsman and a better painter.
Mm-hmm.
And even though those are more sort of traditional, what I guess might be termed old world, old school media, that still is where my heart lies, in trying to be better at those, and but yet still trying to combine those with the opportunities that we have today, you know, and not ignoring these opportunities, which is trying to combine them with technologies. I've always got my eye on those old world things, though, and so if I have to side, I'm going to side that way. But the ability to combine these two and combine them in ways that surprise me and hopefully surprise my audience, that's what I'm interested in. And sometimes I wonder, Am I falling into patterns, or am I falling into, you know, things that I don't want to. I enjoy that element of surprise, and, mm-hmm. and if I'm not surprising myself, then you know I start to question. And I haven't gotten to a place where I've felt like I've stagnated yet, but I'm always wary. I'm always on edge about it. You know, I always want to make sure I'm pushing it a little bit, yeah. Taking a chance.
Well, that's always good, challenging yourself. Now, last night we had a little bit of a conversation about the Science Fiction Hall of Fame, and you went there and you saw something that interested you tremendously. I believe it was something to do with Jimi Hendrix, is that correct?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, I went there because they were kind enough to invite me to present Ed Emshwiller's Hall of Fame Award, and that was just a bolt from the blue. I mean, just an absolutely, like, wow. I couldn't believe they were asking me to come up and do that. And I mean, Ed Emshwiller, as you know, that's a legendary figure in mm-hmm. our field, and you know, sadly, he passed away in 1990. He's not around to see himself inducted, but clearly a very deserving, you know, creator in our field to be inducted in the Hall of Fame. And so to be able to come up there and present his Hall of Fame award, that was something else. Mm-hmm. So that's why I was there. And the Locus Awards, of course, were given in Seattle the same weekend, so mm-hmm. it was just, you know, double the reason. But yeah, I mean, as much as I live, eat, and breathe science fiction and fantasy, and you know, going to that museum is just, you know, nirvana. Yeah, the first thing I did was skip that though and go see the Jimi Hendrix exhibit, just because I love the music. I love mm-hmm. I love what he did in a very short amount of time. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, he literally changed the world. He changed the way we perceived not only music but that instrument. You know, the guitar. And. And seeing the piece of shrapnel that they have there on exhibit within all the other pieces of memorabilia mm-hmm. of the guitar from the Monterey Pop Festival. You know, they actually have a piece of the guitar that, you know, when he broke it on the stage and set it on uh-huh. fire, they actually have a piece there. And, you know, just seeing that stuff for some reason gave me goosebumps. I mean, I just thought, wow, you know, I mean, like the fact that, you know, even though I'm there for science fiction, I'm there. I mean, and Jimmy was science fiction. I mean, let's uh-huh. just be straight, you know? I mean, Jimmy was science fiction. So, you know, I mean, it wasn't like I was, you know, coming from left field to want to go see that stuff first. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I had to go pay my little pilgrimage to go see him. Mm-hmm. So, go ahead.
Of course, I've not been to Seattle. And, of course, you got to meet one of the founders last night of the Science Fiction Hall of Fame.
Robin Wayne Bailey, yeah.
I knew that he was involved in it, but I had no idea.
I didn't know how deep that guy was involved in it either. I had no idea. I was just like, mm-hmm. yeah, what is – I was just, you know, kind of – you know, I met him over there, and or we had crossed paths before, but actually got to, you know, mm-hmm. visit with him for a couple of minutes there. And I knew that he was kind of involved a little deeper than maybe I would have suspected at first. But last night finding out that, man, he was one of the founding forces of inertia behind the whole program, I thought, wow. You know, I mean, this guy's essentially, the Hall of Fame doesn't exist probably if this guy isn't pushing.
Yeah, he's done a tremendous amount. Last year, I had Robin Wayne Bailey, who was our Toastmaster last year, and the year before, Brad Ditton. I had him on a kind of a Battle of the Toastmasters podcast. So,
excellent.
And I didn't know how far those two went back, so it actually turned out really nice.
Yeah, he's a shadowy, shady figure. We have to keep an eye on him.
And Brad Denton does play a mean guitar, too.
Yeah.
Probably not to the level of Hendrix, but yeah, it's pretty entertaining.
Yeah, nobody will. Yeah.
I had David Lee Anderson on Friday, and he brought his guitar, and he can sing.
Yeah, so. Yeah. No, he's quite the musician, quite the musician. I think he's got a CD called Marooned, I believe.
Yes.
Yeah.
He played one of the songs from that. Mm-hmm. And this is going to kind of lead into an odd little question, but are there any other – do you play any musical instruments? Or?
I mean, I do have a Strat. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't sit there and make any effort to play it in front of people. Mm-hmm. I mean – you know, I noodle around with it. Quite honestly, I mean, it sits there outside, just right outside the door of my studio. Mm-hmm. And when I'm stuck on something, I'll literally kind of sit it in my hands and just kind of noodle around on it. Mm-hmm. I mean, not even plug it into the amp, but just sit there and just noodle with it. And it's just it's almost like, you know, you twirl a pin in your hands uh-huh. or, you know, just a nervous little habit. But it's something that just kind of helps me to, I don't know why, it's almost like, you know, it's just a nervous tick that mm-hmm. allows me to massage through a problem. And then all of a sudden it'll hit me and I'll just throw it to the side and go back to what I was doing. But I have to admit, I do kind of use it as a little crutch sometimes to kind of work me through a problem. It's just it's just something to kind of, you know,
yeah, so it's
better than cracking your knuckles or sucking your thumb, I guess.
But so it helps you through your creative process.
I don't know. I'm just noodling on mm-hmm. it, but absentmindedly, mm-hmm. completely absentmindedly. I'm not trying to play a composition or anything,
right.
But I'm just, I'm just sitting there and just noodling around, but while at the same time staring at the visual problem mm-hmm. that I'm trying to work through. And somehow it loosens me up, I guess. I don't know why.
You know, people do things like that. It distracts them, and then suddenly the solution can just come through.
I think you're just kind of untracking a bit, mm-hmm. maybe untightening, hopefully. But anyway, so yeah, that is the truth. But no, I'm not. I have no aspirations of trying to, you know, be a bland lemon, bland lemon Denton or whatever his name is.
Yeah, I got a little video of it, so maybe it'll appear on YouTube. Maybe not.
Yeah, I'm no bland lemon.
Okay. What else? I think I've pretty much covered everything because, you know, it's not the length of the conversation that counts, the quality of the conversation.
That's great. No problem.
And we've covered a lot of material here. And John, I want to thank you for joining me on the Conestoga podcast, and I hope you enjoy the rest of your stay in Tulsa.
Absolutely. It's great to be here. Thank you.
You're welcome.
As it turns out, this was not the end of my interview with John. There were a couple of questions I forgot to ask, and I'll play his answers in a minute. I wanted to take this little interlude to announce a new podcast from yours truly, Chris Marley, Escape from Cubicle 17. Besides sharing the same host, me, it also features interviews with authors, artists, fans, and other professionals in the world of fantasy and science fiction fandom. My first show is available with an interview with the amazing and talented author/editor/publisher, Selena Rosen. This new podcast takes a broader look at science fiction and fantasy, and it will also have new and interesting segments not featured on the Conestoga podcast. So check out escapefromcubicle17.com. Because science fiction isn't just about escape from the ordinary, it's also about seeing the world differently. And now for my postscript with John Picasso.
Well, we're getting to do something a first here. We're doing a little postscript, and I have to apologize to my listeners. I forgot to ask John, what does he have coming up that we can look forward to?
Right now I'm working on a collection of illustrations for the re-release from Del Rey of Michael Moorcock's Elric. They're going to be releasing all of Mike's Elric material in 6 big volumes in trade paperback starting in February of 2008. And they're going to be fully illustrated by a number of illustrators, and I'm very fortunate to be the one who's doing the first one. And that first book will contain The Stealer of Souls and Stormbringer. So that's quite a way to start off. Interestingly, you know, Stormbringer is the end of the epic, but yet it'll be in the first book. But I think the decision to do that was, from what I understand, I could be wrong about this, I think it was Mike's decision because he wanted to release the books in the order they were written as opposed to the chronological order of the story, which is mm-hmm. an interesting approach. The other decision I think Mike had a key role in was that he decided that he wanted these released in trade paperback form.
Mm-hmm.
And that tells you a lot about Mike in that he sees it as, you know, his job to make sure the work gets out to – is accessible to the most people possible. Mm-hmm. So in Mike's mind, you know, by making it a more affordable price tag than it would be in a hardcover, he's giving his audience, his fans, his readers more of a chance to be able to, you know, either relive the experience of the character, you know, maybe they had already known or read the stuff before, or find it for the first time. And mm-hmm. I think it's a smart decision, also a very, you know, compassionate decision to do that. And I think it'd be very tempting and easy to say, yeah, you know, I want a hardcover and I want it with the highest price and, you know, that big tag on it. Mm-hmm. But it's funny that now that it's been, you know, well known across the internet, these are coming out. A lot of collectors are saying, I want that hardcover. So we'll see what happens with that. But I'm doing full interiors for the first volume, and mm-hmm. I'm doing the cover, and it comes out in February. And that's really dominated my entire year. I've uh-huh. been doing a lot of covers, including like the cover for the most recent Sherry Tepper book, The Margarets,
mm-hmm.
The upcoming collections from Bruce McAllister. It's called The Girl Who Loved Animals. And George Alec Effinger's collection actually was just released called 1,000 Deaths. Both of those are from Golden Griffin. You know, any number of titles for Pyre and for Monkey Brain, as well as a few Star Trek jobs I'm doing for Pocket. Mm-hmm. So there's a number of jobs going, but Elric has really dominated. There's another Moorcock book, actually, that's also coming out on Halloween,
mm-hmm.
and it's called The Metatemporal Detective. That comes out from Pyre, and that's a collection of the Mike Moorcock Seton Begg stories. And it's him, Seton Begg, and his adventures across time against Count Zodiac. And of course, Count Zodiac is just another one of Mike's incarnations for Elric of Melnibone.
Okay.
And so for Elric fans, that's kind of one of those must-haves, you know. And so that book will be coming out in late October. So doing the covers for these things is, you know, obviously kept me busy. But Elric has been the main thing, and it's been quite a push.
Well, I suppose if the Science Fiction Book Club picks them up, they might put out hardcovers.
Yeah, they might. They might. I mean, I don't know what the plans are for that, but I'm looking forward to it. Like I said, I'm doing the first one. Mike Kaluta does the second. I believe a guy named Steve Ellis, extremely gifted. I looked him up. I had never heard of him before, but I saw his work, and I thought he was fantastic. He's doing the third volume. I believe Justin Sweet, who did such a great job on the Robert E. Howard Cole volume that Del Rey and Wandering Star put out, he's doing the fourth Elric book, and I don't know who's doing the fifth and sixth yet. But yeah, should be great. Should be great.
And when was this first one going to be out?
The book with the first volume that has my illustrations in it will be out February 2008. So look for that in your stores.
But we got another one coming out a little sooner in the Halloween.
Yeah, Metatemporal Detective. Yeah. And so then after we get done with this interview, I'll go back upstairs and go keep working on those full pages for the first volume.
Well, you certainly sound like you have a lot on your plate.
Yeah, it's been a good time.
Now, I will let you get back to work then.
All right. Sounds good.
Thanks.
We wish John Picasso the best of luck at the Hugos at the upcoming Worldcon in Yokohama, Japan. Or, I should say, Kon wo o inori shite imasu. As I mentioned in the interview, my fellow podcaster, Paul Fisher of the Balticon podcast, and his lovely wife, Martha Holloway, will be at Worldcon as well. Be sure to check out his very fine podcast at balticonpodcast.org. Other people I know that are going are Richard and Lynn Morgan, who work on the Conestoga with me. And finally, there are three from the Kansas City in 2009 Worldcon bid who will be there as well, Margene Baum, Jim Murray, and Paula Murray. So when casting your vote for 2009, remember, some of the best barbecue in the universe can be found in Kansas City. I hope you all have a great time. For those of you lucky enough to go and don't know any Japanese, here are two useful phrases. Nihongo ga wakarimasen, I don't understand Japanese. Nihongo ga wakarimasen. And anata wa eigo o hanashimasu ka? Do you speak English? Anata wa eigo o hanashimasu ka? So, until the next Conestoga podcast, mata ato de. Thank you.